Department of Philosophy and Literature. He's done a lot of work on Bohr and the connection to continental philosophy, and today he's going to tell us about the role of technology in global foundations.
Right. To be correct, the title, I think.
Well, it's not so much a role of technology. It's a good mistake, thank you. that in a way it is a nature of quantum foundationless technological. It's probably going to be a kind of talk which is going you rarely would hear, right? It is a talk on philosophy of physics, but in somewhat different philosophy of physics. So this philosophy of physics which deal with how a physicist think. It's about the nature of thinking in physics. And let me just situate it by way of the background a little bit. When I was young, so much younger than today, and then when I was Russian, so I studied quantum theory in the University of St. Petersburg and also mathematics with Ludwig Fadeev, who is a pretty prominent quantum field theorist, right? And when he gave a talk on quantum, a course on quantum mechanics, one of the things he assigned for this talk was a Feynman's Nobel Prize lecture, which was not terribly technical, but the reason for that was that he said, look, I assign it to you because it's one of the very few things where you learn how one thinks when one does a quantum field theory, right? And that sort of stuck in my mind, and I always kind of remember about that. Of course, at that time, I had a healthy contempt for philosophy because I was doing primarily mathematics and physics, and my mathematical field was algebraic geometry and representation of algebraic groups. It was pretty technical. And for a while, I wasn't really doing any kind of connections between philosophical thinking and quantum theory before I received a letter from David Merman, in which he said that classic David Merman, in which he said, well, having started to read your book in my own reprehensible manner in the middle of chapter 6, I thought what you were talking about, the EPR experiment. And first he said, I thought you were just simply wrong, just like Abraham Pais, whom you cite. That was encouraging, right? So that I was not completely wrong. So as it happened, I was not entirely wrong, but that gradually brought me back to the interest in more technical aspect of quantum physics. And this talk is the product of that. At the top, there are two recent articles which are related to the subject of my talk. And one of them is probably a matter of principle. The principle of quantum theory, Dirac's equation, and quantum information is in part initiated a discussion with Lucian I had, which resulted in my speaking now here. So in any event, so this is a talk on philosophy of physics as philosophy of thinking, right? Let me just start kind of a little bit very simple, that in a way, I would say that philosophical thinking is defined by invention of new concept. I give you some examples, Plato's ideas, Descartes' cogito, Leibniz's monads, etc. Mathematical and physical thinking is also the invention of new concept. But these are mathematical in physics, and in physics a hybrid concept. That is to say, which combine a mathematical and physical element, and we shall see how it works in particular in the work of Doriana and Lucian Hardy in quantum information theory. And in fact, I borrow that idea of hybrid concept from Lucian. He mentions that, right? And so I give you an example. The one is example you know think about, but that's an example nevertheless. The concept of motion in classical physics, which is not, which is defined mathematically by assigning to at each point both a position and a velocity or a momentum, and that creates a mathematical concept of classical physics, the central mathematical concept, very different from Aristotle's concept of motion, which doesn't have this type of structure. Aristotle's concept of motion is a philosophical concept. So the modern mathematics borrows this concept and gives it a mathematical structure. So that was a really crucial moment with Galileo and Newton. And the opposite end of it, of course, is the Heisenberg concept of new quantum variables as unbounded infinite matrices with complex coefficients, from which one derives essentially a form of Born rules for this particular place, the probability of electrons transitions between an energy level and the atom. That was a radically new concept, which in a way transformed the whole enterprise of fundamental physics, even as against relativity, because technically, as we shall see, this concept virtually dispenses with the idea of motion, right? In fact, in this concept, even though Heisenberg called it new kinematics, but he doesn't really talk about motion, right? And I just mentioned it, art. In art, I think the primary way of thinking in art is the invention of new compositions, right? So the essential aspect of art is not so much representation, but a composition. And here I use the Picasso's Cubist painting and more interestingly, Kandinsky's painting, which is called composition. And Kandinsky understood that the essence of art is composition, so his paintings are abstract. All he does are only compositions. So obviously, there are two points which I want to qualify very quickly. I don't mean, of course, that these three ways of thought completely separates these three areas. That's not true at all. They're always combined. Inside our heads, we practice all these modes of thought. But what is crucial is that each one of them is essential for the disciplinary functioning of a particular discipline. In fact, in philosophy, it gets a little bit complicated. If you do analytic philosophy, that your primary mode of thinking is logic rather than the invention of concepts. It's a study of logical propositions, right? While in continental philosophy, I mentioned the key figures there, it is the invention of new concepts. So I think I just want to make it clearer that it's not just that things are completely separable, but just relate the matter of emphasis rather than absolute separations between these two ways of thought. And another thing I want to say about that thought in that sense is something which is the mean with which mind or even the brain confronts the world and chaos in the world. And in a way, chaos, of course, is an enemy of thought, but it's also the greatest friend of all creative thought. The moment our relationships to chaos disappear, thoughts becomes just an opinion that is solidified into something rather than develops. And that's why our newspapers only have opinion columns, but never thought columns, right? So you see, so that's an important point. Now, now I come to really the subject of my paper. So here's these three pictures. One is, of course, one of the many famous picture of the discovery of the Higgs boson, right? The next one, you can see the same picture and some of the aspect of technological devices which were involved, which are, of course, immense, right? And as we know, the history of the technology didn't work right away. It took really years to fix it, et cetera. And then this is the mathematical expression of the non-abelian Higgs model, the action for this non-abelian Higgs model. Now, my question is this. What the hell does it all mean, right? And how it comes about, okay? That's another picture, right? And I want to say, if I ask this question, what it all means and how it come about, this question relates to the basic question of causality. I have a few quotations. One is from Plato. Inquiry into nature is a search for causes of each thing. Why each thing come into existence, why it goes out of existence, why it exists. That's Plato, 5th century. Then Kant, probably the philosopher who made, along with Hume, the greatest contribution in a critique of causality, but still keep the same concept of Plato. If therefore we experience that something happened, then we always presuppose that something else preceded it, which it follows in accordance with the rule. And there I have a quotation from Max Born, who essentially repeat Kant's view of causality, right? And I call this concept of causality is a classical causality, right? Is a classical concept of causality in which, and that concept was in place in the whole history of Western philosophy and physics until quantum mechanics. I think as Bohr noted, the discovery of the quantum of action, which is essentially Planck's H, implies a shortcoming of the causality ideal itself. That is to say, by which he means classical causality, right? And then here's another quotation. It is more important to realize that the recourse to probability law under such circumstances of quantum mechanics, right, is essentially different in aim from the familiar application of statistical considerations as practical means of accounting for the properties of mechanical system of great structural complexity. In fact, in quantum physics, we are presented not with intricacies of this kind, but with the inability of the classical frame of concept to comprise the peculiar feature of indivisibility or individuality characterizing elementary quantum processes. So Bohr essentially says that another quantum theory is that classical causality does not apply to quantum processes, right? So in effect, I defined here classical causality is an ontological category, which is part of reality. It relates the behavior of physical systems in such a way that the state of the system at a given point determines its state at a subsequent point or even as a previous point uniquely in a determinate way, right? I distinguish it from determinism, which I associate with our ability to predict the behavior of such system ideally exactly. The system could be causal, but it doesn't have to be deterministic, because if the system is complex enough, we don't have such an ability to make such predictions as in chaos theory and classical statistical physics, but at bottom, this system are causal. That doesn't mean that one cannot deny quantum causality, right? I give you a preliminary definition, which I borrow from Kirbel, Adriana, and Perinotti. Lucian Hardy uses the same definition. The probability of measurement outcome at a certain time does not depend on the choice of measurement that it will be performed later. I'm going to add something to that, in which in saying that there is a quantum causality which is probabilistic in nature, that whatever happens as a quantum event and is registered as such, thus providing us with the initial data, defines the possible set of, in general, probabilistically or statistically predictable outcome of future event and irrevocably rules out the possibility of our prediction concerning certain other, such as, and in particular, complementary events. That is to say, complementarity, Bohr saw it as a generalization of causality, because once you have to, once you measure the momentum at a certain point, it excludes predictions of the position at a future point, even probabilistically, while the predictions of the momentum will be probabilistic, right? Now, another kind of philosophical definition, which I now borrow from Einstein, the two types of theories I'm going to be concerned with. One are constructive theories, which, according to Einstein, built up a picture of a more complex phenomena out of the material of a relatively simple former scheme from which they start out. And his example is a kinetic theory of gases, which seeks to reduce mechanical, thermal, and diffusional processes to movement of molecules, to build them up out of the hypothesis of molecular motion, described by the laws of classical mechanics. On the other hand, principle theories, which Einstein defined, employ the analytic, not the synthetic method. The elements from which their basis and starting point are not hypothetically constructed, but empirically discovered one. General characteristics of natural processes, principles, that gives rise to mathematically formulated criteria, which the separate processes or theoretical representation of them have to satisfy. That's as he uses thermodynamics as a classical example of the principles theory, which is not constructive in that way. And of course, then he talks about relativity theory, which is both constructive and principle. Now, my argument is going to be that I take it as a definition of principle, that quantum mechanics is essentially the principle theory, at least in the interpretation I'm going to adopt here. Okay. Now, here's Bohr's initial approach to quantum mechanics and in Heisenberg's initial approach to quantum mechanics and Bohr's initial interpretation of it, these were the key principles. Let me stop this for the moment and say, well, I'm going to argue here that in fact, what Heisenberg was doing in his discovery of quantum mechanics was a form of quantum information theory, as opposed to type of quantum mechanics which Schrödinger tried to do afterwards. We usually don't think about it because almost no one ever reads Heisenberg paper anymore. We got very eclipsed after the Schrödinger's discovery, everyone uses Schrödinger's equation, but I think Heisenberg paper is absolutely decisive in terms of a different way of thinking about the nature of quantum mechanics, right? Which then got sort of moved a little bit more to more realist paradigm. The person who really understood profoundly what was going in Heisenberg's paper, which he read extremely carefully, was Paul Dirac. And he read this paper very carefully, and all Dirac works is of a similar nature, right? So now, in Heisenberg's and Bohr, who interpreted quantum mechanics, Heisenberg, three key principles. The one is the principle of quantum discreteness, right? That is to say that you deal only with discrete observable phenomena in quantum mechanics. So you cannot really, they're not connected by any kind of process about which you can say anything. All these phenomena are discrete, right? This discreteness is not the same as the discreteness of atomic objects themselves. So for Bohr, the quantum of action, the Planck's H, was a symbol of the fact that you could only deal with discrete phenomena, which suggests already in itself that the quantum mechanics could be more similar to probability theory rather than classical mechanics, because in every probability theory, which generally deal with discrete prediction on the basis of information at this point, what happened in the future point. Okay, so that was the first principle. The second principle, and that is probably the single more central principle of quantum mechanics for Heisenberg, was the principle of probabilistic and statistical nature of all quantum predictions. That is to say, all predictions in quantum mechanics are of probabilistic and statistical nature. They call it the QP principle, right? And finally, Heisenberg, in order to derive quantum mechanics, used Bohr's correspondence principle, but he gave to this principle a new form. And that was the radical move in itself, because the previous old quantum theory was trying to do this. The theory adopted the variables which were derived from classical physics, such as position, momentum, etc., and tried, they knew, of course, that the equations of classical physics wouldn't work in describing the behavior of electrons and the atoms. So they tried to adjust equations, and sometimes they were quite successful, like both Bohr and Sommerfeld did that. Heisenberg made a kind of a radical move. He decided to take the equations of classical mechanics in an unaltered form. He just used the equations of classical mechanics for the quantum mechanics, but he made a radical move because he changed the variable. So he reversed the previous strategy. He said, I'm going to take these equations, but I'm going to use different variables. The reason that he took these equations was the correspondence principle, because he knew that when the electrons are far enough from the atom, they could be described by means of classical equations. That doesn't mean they behave classically, but they could be described, because you still can observe quantum effects there, but they could be described by means of classical equations. So that was a form of correspondence principle. He transferred the equation back, but he made a radical move. He introduces the new variables. And I'll show momentarily why he needed to do that and how he came to that. But that was a radical structure. And these were three fundamental principles which he used in his discovery of quantum mechanics. The quantum discreteness principle, which applies at the level of the observed phenomena, the quantum probability principle, and the correspondence principle. And the correspondence principle was crucial because it gave him the equations through which he could predict what was going on. So that one, the mathematics was derived from the correspondence principle, but he had to introduce a new variable, which essentially was a kind of guessing work in part. Okay. All right. Now, Bohr's interpretation, of course, added some new principles, right? The most famous one is the complementarity principle of Bohr, which is often misunderstood, but it's quite crucial that Bohr complementarity means three things: a mutual exclusivity of certain phenomena, events, or conceptions, and yet the possibility of applying each one of them separately at any given point, and the necessity of using all of them at different moments for the comprehensive account of the totality of phenomena that one must consider in quantum physics. Now, it is the point B, which is often forgotten, right? That it's absolutely central for a Bohr understanding of complementarity that at any given point, you can make either momentum measurement or position measurement, but you can never make both. And that has a crucial implication because that's why, as I mentioned before, he called that generalization of causality, because that measurement is going to determine which probabilities, or as Schrödinger would call them, catalogs of expectations are possible and which others are no longer possible, right? So that in that sense, it puts constraints of what kind of probabilistic predictions is possible to make. So it's very important that in Bohr's concept of complementarity is not simply about measurement. It's about what kind of predictions are possible. To anticipate that a little bit, I won't be able to go into that. His reply to EPR, to a paper, was really based on that idea that the complementarity constrains what kind of predictions are possible in quantum mechanics and which are not. Then Bohr introduced eventually, not right away, what I call the reality without realism principle. In quantum mechanics, he said, we're not dealing with orbital renunciation of more detailed analysis of atomic phenomena, but with the recognition that such an analysis is in principle excluded beyond certain point. It was a radical assumption which was implicit in Heisenberg, but Heisenberg didn't make it in that form. Bohr's interpretation implies that it's not possible to have a representation of quantum processes in accordance with any sort of previous realist conceptions, right? It became a fundamental principle. It was no longer possible, right? And as I already mentioned before, I'll come back to that momentarily, right? That principle implied that quantum mechanics is more of the species of probability theory than the species of classical physics, et cetera. So this is really a radical structure. I'll come to that in a second. Now, this principle, of course, is incompatible with classical causality. It's Schrödinger in 1935. If the classical state does not exist at any moment, it can hardly be changing causally, right? So, your observation. However, of course, it is compatible with quantum causality as I described earlier. Okay. Now, I don't have time to describe it, but actually the reality without realism principle could be inferred from the complementarity principle because the latter prevents us from ascertaining complete composition of the whole from parts. To the degree the concept of the whole even applies because the complementary parts never add to the whole in the way they would do in classical physics. And that becomes really crucial, especially in the EPR type of argument and the entangled state. Let's just register that. Now, we can ask, what are the reasons for reality without realism principle? Heisenberg made a statement of it right soon after the discovery of quantum mechanics, in which he says, it's not surprising that our language should be incapable of describing processes occurring within atoms. For as had been remarked by Bohr, incidentally, it was invented to describe the experiences of daily life, and this consists only of processes involving exceedingly large number of atoms. Furthermore, it is very difficult to modify our language so that it will be able to describe these atomic processes, for words can only describe things of which we can form mental pictures. And this ability, too, is the result of experience. That statement is not entirely correct, but the essential point is correct. Fortunately, then, he says, mathematics is not subject to this limitation. And it has been possible to invent a mathematical scheme, the quantum theory, which seems entirely adequate for the treatment of atomic processes. Obviously, some would, and Einstein one, for one, would not agree that it is entirely adequate. What he means by that, of course, that you can, in spite of the lack of the realist description, you can have a mathematical machinery which could probabilistically predict what is going to happen in the experiment. And that was all you could experimentally do. It's not that it was a deficiency of quantum mechanics. It's an experimental fact of quantum probability principle that all our predictions are probabilistical. Probabilistic, no matter what theory you want to use them. Even in Bohm's theory, which is a causal and realist theory, the quantum prediction, which coincide with those of quantum mechanics, are also statistical and probabilistic. There, of course, the difference is that there you have an actual ontology which is literally distorted by measurement, right? In Bohr's scheme, the concept of distortion by measurement is not really applicable, according to him. Right? So I'll give you an example. One can get an idea of the quantum smallness on the basis of the following observation. If in order to observe the motion of the moon around the Earth, every time we would have a Jupiter to hit it with a Jupiter, then you would have an idea which is kind of closer to quantum mechanics and would study the debris which happens after, right? Then it would be similar what is happening to quantum mechanics. That way you have a kind of picture which I showed before, which you have in the case of the Higgs boson. We are kind of lucky that in the solar system, we can observe things without disturbing them appreciably. That became our model of classical physics. But if in order to make that observation, you would have to hit the moon with the Jupiter and study debris, the picture would be very different. Now, the important points to be made here, actually, is not so much that classical physics is free of this limitation, because it's also, I'm sorry, the mathematics is free of this limitation. It's also true in classical physics, okay? Technically, in classical physics, we use mathematics, which is not necessarily completely dependent on our everyday intuition. And that's why when you move to analytic mechanics of Lagrange and Hamilton, et cetera, this mechanics is not as dependent on our visual intuitions, right? The crucial point is that Heisenberg was able to invent his mathematical scheme, which was able to do predictions, right, in the absence of this limitation, right? Okay, now, this Bohr. It's a very important statement. It happens after Heisenberg's discovery of quantum mechanics and the work of Jordan and Born, but before Schrödinger equation. It really is an interesting moment in the end of 1925 when Bohr wrote this essay, Atomic Theory and Mechanics, which was actually already ready before that. He modified it. He had one section after Heisenberg discovered quantum mechanics. So he says this. In this theory, matrix mechanics, the attempt is made to transcribe every use of mechanical concept in a way suited to the nature of quantum theory, and such that at every stage of the computation, only directly observable quantities enter. In contrast to ordinary mechanics, the new mechanics does not deal with a space-time description of the motion of the atomic particles. I mean, this is a revolution, right? This is a radical revolution and never happened in physics before, right? It operates with manifold of quantities which replace the harmonic oscillation component of the motion and symbolize the possibility of transition between stationary states. That's what happens. That Heisenberg takes the same symbols which are used in the Fourier form of equations of classical mechanics, but he gives them a totally different meaning. He changes the variables, keeping the same equations, right? So no longer orbits. There's no orbits. There was an interesting exchange of letters between Pauli and Heisenberg in which Pauli said, well, what happens to the orbits? Heisenberg, my whole point was to get rid of orbits completely, right? These quantities satisfy certain relations which take place of the mechanical equation of motion and quantization rule of the old quantum theory, right? So the old quantum theory now is replaced by a totally different type of theory, which uses directly the equation of classical motion and uses new variables. Here's the scheme. What you have is this. You have a hydrogen atom with the data, which is technically the information. And then you can say spectra, which is another data and another form of information. And you have mathematical scheme, matrix non-mechanics, I call it, because there's no reason to call it either kinematics or mechanics because it doesn't describe what is going on. It is a probability theory. Physical interpretation, information processing between technological devices. Philosophical interpretation changes accordingly. Okay, so I think that I remember Lucian was in the audience that I gave this talk about Heisenberg's information theory at some point, but even though it was talk was reasonably well received, but people didn't respond to that because, as I said, we don't read Heisenberg paper anymore. What I want to show here is what is type of thinking Heisenberg engages in creating this new quantum mechanics, right? So it's one data, the other possible data, and the mathematical schemes which present the transitions of the probabilities of predicting one data on the basis of data which is already here. That is without any concern for what is going on with electrons themselves, right? Because it's not possible, he said, right? You can't attribute that. And notice, by the way, that there are complex statistical elements because the moment of emission of the photons is never completely determined either. You only see the traces of what has happened. So in a way, this is a theory of the events, not in space and time at the level of quantum object, but only in space and time at the level of measure instruments. Okay. Right. Now, there's an important point, right? Heisenberg commented on that. He said, it should be distinctly understood, however, that this deduction of fundamental equations of quantum mechanics cannot be deduction in the mathematical sense of the word, since the equations to be obtained from themselves are postulates of the theory, although they are made highly plausible, but their correspondence with the experiment. That is to say that in a way, they are not really fully rigorously defined from any mathematical structure. They are partly guessed. But that doesn't mean they're not derived from anything. That is to say, there's not a complete derivation, but it's a partial derivation for the principle they use. Later on, as I'm sure many of you know, people like Mauro Dariana, Lucian Hardy, Fuchs, and others are trying to do this a little bit more rigorously, at least for finite dimensional quantum theory. Now, and here actually I have a discussion of how it happens in Heisenberg's paper, because you can see that he start really with Bohr's rule from frequencies, which is the manifestation of quantum discreteness, right? And because of that, right, because of the difference from how these things appear in classical theory is going to lead to the difference in two theories, right? So he, and then he makes a really an extraordinary move. He said, in order to complete the description of radiation in accordance with mathematical correspondence principle, it is necessary to have not only frequencies, but also amplitude. That is to say, that is how he thinks. A correspondence principle that whatever is in quantum, it happens in classical physics, should be transferred mathematically into quantum physics, but have to be giving a totally different meaning. Because he says Fourier representation has frequencies and amplitude. We have to have both in quantum theory, but they cannot have the same meaning. So the concept of amplitude, for all intents and purposes, becomes really the concept of probability amplitude. That's what happened already in Heisenberg's paper, right? So in this way, right, so he says, change the mathematical correspondence principle by using the same equation. And now the problem, a difficult and at first sight even insurmountable problem is now apparent. The phase contained in that expression A, right? seem to be devoid of any physical significance in quantum theory, since in these theories, frequencies are in general not commensurable with their harmonics, right? He has to, it cannot give the classical meaning to this element, right? And he says, however, we shall see presently that also in quantum theory, the phase has a definite significance, which is analogous to the significance in quantum theory. Now, analogous could only mean here that rather than being analogous physically, the way the phase functions mathematically is analogous to the way the classical phase functions mathematically in classical theory, or analogous in accordance with the mathematical forms of the correspondence principle. So Heisenberg, he says, he looks at classical physics, the equation, and he says similar combination seems to be impossible in a unique manner and therefore not meaningful in view of equal weight of variables. And he says, however, it seems that we can find these things which could satisfy this type of equation by replacing these variables with the different variables. Now, this is another revolutionary moment in Heisenberg's discovery, because these things are infinite square matrices of the complex elements, which are amplitude and frequencies through which you can relate to probability. But Heisenberg, at the time, had to think how to arrange this element into the new element. It was a new concept. You've never seen previously in physics that the variables would have been matrices in that way, right? That is to say, it seems to us so natural that we don't think about that. But he clearly thought that you have double these kind of transition things and you could arrange them into the mathematical matrix. He didn't know matrix theory, right? So he has to reinvent it and to find, therefore, it's a mathematical invention. How do you multiply these two things? It's a matrix multiplication which he needed. He, of course, he only used the Newton's equation, so he only needed x squared, which he commutes, of course. But to solve this equation, he needed non-commutation. So what happens that, of course, this multiplication is in general not commutative, right? So that was a totally different change in the reinvention of the structure. That I want to trace here is to show how the mathematical structure arises from the physical conditions of probabilistic prediction, and you have to give it a new structure. You have to give it a new mathematical structure in which the elements which you use are arranged in a particular way. We'll see later, if I have enough time, that in more recent approaches in quantum information theory, in Bob Koch and others who use category theory, you still have to derive the mathematics of the theory. You will need to have some form arrangement, or either the data or the circuits of measurement, which are not random. They have to be arranged in a particular way. So I think the Heisenberg makes several radical moves, right? He eliminates the space-time description of of quantum processes. He uses the probability, and his question is, how do I relate the combination of mathematical element, how I organize them, right? It really is, you can say, it's really almost like an artistic composition. It's really like a sort of Kandinsky putting it in an abstract way, how you arrange these things in the right way as an abstract element. Yeah.
In fact, there's the usual picture that is very abstract, but what's amazing in Heisenberg's picture is that he's very concrete. You know, saying I'm going to talk to you about observable. I'm not going to talk about things that do not exist, like space and time.
Right.
And
yeah.
So we usually present, you know, it's usually taken as being an abstraction, whereas in his picture, it's a realization.
It's a combination, but you know, let me correct you slightly, because
there is an abstraction.
It's related, of course. That's the whole point.
How would you put the mathematical abstraction in the service of what could be observed? But it's interesting that the title of his paper, which he said, right, it's not, he said, relationships between the qualities which are in principle observable. So the crucial point from the, actually it's not the title, it's an abstract. He's a relationship between quantities which are in principle observable. That means that relationships is mathematical. It's inherent in the mathematical structure, but yeah, I agree with you. So essentially, of course, we know that Heisenberg scheme essentially amounts to the Hilbert space operator scheme, but the, so I think now Bohr, in the same paper, comments a little bit later, he says, it will interest mathematical circles that the mathematical instruments, an interesting word, and words and Bohr are always interesting, right? Mathematical instruments created by the higher algebra play an essential part in a rational formalization of the new quantum mechanics, right? That's the general proof on the conservation theorem, etc. To the physicist, he says, it will at first seem deplorable that in atomic problems, we have apparently met with such a limitation of our usual means of visualization, even deeper, with any capacity to represent quantum level processes, right? This regret will, however, have to give way to thankfulness that mathematics in this field too presents us with the tools to prepare the way for new progress. A tough luck, of course. It's not that physicists, they appreciated the capacity of quantum mechanics, but on that point, very few actually agreed with Bohr at the time, or even still now. So I just simply repeat this scheme here to illustrate what he is doing. In one respect, this quotation is very unusual for Bohr, because we usually associate Bohr's thinking with the role of measuring instrument. Here he uses the word mathematical instruments, right? So in my understanding of it, and I'll come to that later in his talk, mathematics is also a technology of thought. So you can say that new quantum mechanics was connecting these two technologies, experimental and mathematical, in a totally new way. And that was, and in that way, it was close to quantum information theory. Of course, I'm not saying that Heisenberg already anticipated, discovered quantum information theory is not my point. My point is rather that the elements, right, which then gradually developed in quantum information theory, they didn't come from nothing. They were not given to Lucian, Chris, Fuchs, Paris, Merman by God into their head, right? They're part of this history of quantum theory, and I want to locate those elements, right, which became so central to that development later on, right? And one of the reasons in that history is that the role of Schrödinger equation and Schrödinger's kind of ideology was constantly inhibiting this type of approach, even though technically Schrödinger equation is the same thing. It's the same type of machine for prediction. It's not the way Schrödinger wanted to see it, of course, and many others, but from that point of view, it doesn't make any difference. It's the same mathematical machinery. Okay, now let me stop briefly, a brief digression on the nature of the cubism, right? Which is, by which I actually mean cubism with C rather than quantum Bayesianism primarily, even though this picture is taken from the article in Nature on the cubism. Now, what is interesting about that this is the picture by the cubist painting Jean Metzinger, a woman on a horse, which Niels Bohr had in his own apartment. He bought it in 1942, and this, there's a description of this painting from Wikipedia. It deserves its own place in Wikipedia, right, this particular painting. The Metzinger is a relatively minor cubist. The artist has broken down the picture plane into facets, presenting multiple aspects of the subject simultaneously. The concept pronounced by Metzinger, since considered a founding principle of cubism, would soon find its way via complementarity into foundations of Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. The fact that a complete description of one
and the same subject may require diverse point of view which defy a unique description, right? That's what you would expect. But actually, I think if I look at another painting by Braque, which is a more interesting painting, I think that one can take a somewhat different point from cubism. One could experience a cubist painting aesthetically, of course, compositionally, and in this sense, as abstracted from reality, the reality of material of human world. If, however, one wants to relate such a painting to either reality, one could only do that insofar as one treating the painting similarly to quantum phenomena reasonably predicts, bets on such a reality, which is thus constructible from these paintings, right? That is to say, our sense of the reality from this type of painting is a guess with certain degree of probability how these things would look in this. And that's, I think, why Bohr bought the painting. Not so much because it's illustrated complementarity, because the epistemology of it was similar to what he was interested in. Einstein, incidentally, never exhibited any interest in modern art. And he was, of course, a very accomplished violin player, while Bohr was a very bad piano player, right? The piano is obviously a more quantum instrument than violin as well. Anyway, okay. Now, I'm going to make somewhat more radical point. Heisenberg's revolutionary thinking not only introduced a new mathematical model in physics, but also established a new way of doing theoretical physics. Moreover, this way of thinking also redefined experimental physics, at least one type of understanding of what experimental physics is in quantum regimes. Some might, of course, think otherwise is the experimental or theoretical physicists concerning what they're actually doing. I can't stop that, right? But from that perspective, the practice of experimental physics no longer consists, as in classical physics, in tracking the independent behavior of the system considered. Instead, it consists in unavoidably creating configuration by now almost unbelievable in their complexity, like the linear hadron collider where Higgs boson are discovered, of experimental technology that reflects the fact that what happens is unavoidably defined by what experiments we perform, how we interact with quantum objects, rather than only with their independent behavior. So I want to say by that, right, that the experimental physics is now fundamentally technological. It has to do with creation of the configuration of technology, which essentially information processional in that way, through which we relate to quantum objects, rather than making observations concerning the objects themselves. Okay, these configurations embody the effects of the interaction between quantum objects and measuring instruments through which effects quantum objects are defined and when possible distinguished from one another. Now I emphasize unavoidably because of course we change things in classical physics but in quantum mechanics is unavoidable. From that perspective of Bohr's and Heisenberg's viewpoint, anything you can possibly experimentally observe are the effects of the interaction between quantum object and measuring instrument mediated by a very complex set of interactions. The practice of theoretical physics no longer consists in offering an idealized mathematical description or even representation of quantum objects and their behavior. Instead, it consists in developing mathematical machinery that is able to predict, in general, probabilistically, the effects in question manifest in the outcome of quantum event and of the correlations between these events. So it is quite a fundamental change. If you're a theoretical physicist, you can say virtually, right? I don't care what my mathematical machinery describes insofar as it produces correct predictions of effects which I observe in measuring instrument. On the one hand, it liberates it from a certain constraint which classical physics imposes upon you. On the other hand, it creates a sort of different way of doing theoretical physics. You can say almost that quantum mechanics was the first truly experimental physics and the first truly mathematical physics, because the way you do your experiment defines the reality. It doesn't mean that there is no world. The world, of course, exists from the quantum point of view. But the way you perform your experiment defines what is going to happen, rather than simply that you experience tracking, which something that would happen in any event. On the other hand, it is truly mathematical because it's only mathematics, as Heisenberg said, which enables you to do that. Okay? In a certain sense, in fact, you experiment with mathematics as well. And again, you can say that Heisenberg's invention of quantum theory was experiment with mathematical structures, which enabled him to produce what was going to happen. Now, obviously, the situation which I just described becomes quite a bit more complex in quantum field theory, because you have a much more complex configurations of observed phenomena than in quantum mechanics. You have a much more complex structure of theoretical prediction, and hence the relationships between mathematics and what you observe. And you have a much more complex and in quantum mechanics nature of the mathematical formalism of quantum field theory and the mathematical procedures involved responding to situation one and two. And you can say the discovery of the Higgs boson may be the most recent spectacular example of this quantum mechanical situation. In this case, this technology, staggering to begin with, was also supplemented, arguably, for the first time, or nearly first time, to the constitutive degree of the digital technology. The discovery of the predictions of Higgs boson in specific term would not be possible from the role of digital technology. So essentially, it involves two technology, right? So, and I think this situation became first apparent in the case of Dirac equation, which I don't have enough time to go through the, but the derivation of Dirac equation, this is the first paper which I sent, which I cited here, is really quite extraordinary in the sense that it uses two fundamental sets of principles. One, the principles of quantum mechanics, which is basically quantum probability principle. The crucial point was the conservation of probability current. And the second was the principle of relativity. Now, there was an equation before Dirac of Klein-Gordon equation, right, which was trying to accomplish that. And there is a famous conversation between Bohr and Dirac on that subject, in which Bohr asked Dirac what he was doing. And he says, I'm trying to derive the equation for a relativistic electron. And Bohr says, Klein already solved this problem. And Dirac was right, and Bohr should have known better, because the Klein-Gordon equation respects the relativity principle, okay? Because time and space enter symmetrically, and they're even actually interchangeable. However, it does not respect sufficiently the principle of quantum mechanics. Why? Because in a Klein-Gordon equation is linear in the second derivative of Bohr's time and space, but Schrödinger equation is linear in time. So Dirac understood very well that in order to maintain both principles together, he needed the differential equation which would be linear in the first order derivative in space and time. That was really a crucial move on the part of Dirac. And in a way, his way of doing it is quite extraordinary. In that sense, it was different from Heisenberg, more formal. That is to say, he took this property in Dirac and manipulated the equation. And only then he said, let's try to find variables. And he says, we have the Pauli matrices, but they're not sufficient. So eventually, so you see Dirac's equation really is really crucial. The new mathematical elements a 4x4 matrices in this equation and the four component wave functions. So it's a multi-component wave function was introduced by Pauli already, but is a four component, right? And this equation is beautiful. I think it's even in a more beautiful form is written in Dirac's commemorating plate in Westminster Abbey, but it's not actually as simple as one thing, because it unfolds into quite complex equation, and you can see that the Hilbert space at stake here has this kind of element. Now, of course, what was remarkable in this equation is that both Dirac and more so Heisenberg thought that this equation is wrong, because it has, of course, negative energy solutions, right? But in fact, that's precisely what happened. So the Dirac equation really was the next move in transforming elementary particle physics, because the identity of particles could no longer be maintained even within the single experiment. That is to say, essentially, if you make a measurement in quantum mechanics, you will observe either electron or sometimes nothing. But if you make a measurement in a high energy regime of quantum field theory, you can observe all manner of things. And that's why there's some discussion on matrix variable and how it goes on to all the way to Gell-Mann. But I just cite Heisenberg here. The Dirac discovery of antimatter is perhaps the biggest change of all the biggest changes in physics in our century, because it changed our whole picture of matter. It was one of the most spectacular consequences of Dirac discovery, that the whole concept of elementary particles collapsed completely, right? So I think that that is, you can see that Dirac's thinking was really derived in large measure from Heisenberg's idea. You have to find the mathematics which correspond to a kind of observed event and fulfill certain set of principle. The key difference was the principle was the principles of special probability theory. They have to be incorporated, and that gave the particular shape of his equation. But it was not about ever describing the actual motion of the electron. All right, now, let me say a few words before I conclude about how some of these things work in quantum information theory, which is a principle theory. I use for the moment briefly the work of Dariana and then Hardy. This work is very important because it extends that idea with which I started here, that Heisenberg versions of quantum mechanics is an extension of more an extension of probability theory than of classical mechanics and even relativity, right? So they introduced the set of axioms or postulates, the terminology fluctuated, doesn't matter at the moment, or as well as principles, right? That the, which define a general probabilistic structure of probabilistic information theory. And then there will be one postulate, which they call the purification postulate, which distinguishes quantum information probabilistic theory from all other. Now, so you can see that there's kind of general ideology behind that, right? That you introduce a very general framework of quantum information theory, right? Or rather, general framework of probabilistic information theory, from which you want to derive quantum information theory by means of specific postulates which could do that. Okay, it's somewhat similar to Heisenberg or Dirac, in which what will distinguish quantum mechanics as a principal postulate. And they use purification postulate, which is essentially is taking almost straight from Heisenberg. I'm sorry, from Schrödinger, 1935 paper, which really says, which is about entanglement, right? Which Heisenberg, which Schrödinger, the Freudian slip, right? So says that he calls it the characteristic trait of quantum mechanics, right? In which he says that the a distinctive feature of quantum theory, that ignorance about a part is always compatible with the maximal knowledge about the whole. That is the fundamental postulate which distinguishes quantum information theories from other theories. Okay. All right. Now I'm going to pause because I'm running out of time, right? What I want to say this, that of course they need to do something else. Both Deriano and co-workers, Perinotti and Carabella, as well as Lucian Hardy and his kind of thing. You have to find, nevertheless, the structure which will give you the mathematics of quantum theory. That still is a task, right? To give you the mathematics of quantum theory. And I think that in, I use Deriano first, and the operational probabilistic framework combines the operational language of circuits with the toolbox of probability theory. On the one hand, experiments are described by circuits resulting from the connections of physical devices. On the other hand, each device in a circuit can have classical outcome, and the theory provides the probability distribution of outcome from the from when the devices are connected to form closed circuits. That is, circuits that start with the preparation and that with measurement. Now, it seems to me that it's actually not that far from the way Heisenberg thinks about this, his discovery, because what you have the measuring instrument and you have two sets of circuits. Because in a certain sense, you know, the double slit, for example, a double slit arrangement for a double slit experiment is a circuit. When you have both slits open and no counter installed, it's a circuit for a continuous variable, but that's a circuit, right? And you have the probability between them. Now, Heisenberg, of course, in order to derive the mathematics, he uses, as I said before, the correspondence principle, right? The mathematical structure is given by the equations of classical physics, which incidentally you cannot do in a finite dimensional quantum mechanics because there is no corresponding classical equations. If you think about spin, it's a fundamentally quantum variables which doesn't have classical equivalent. But so Heisenberg again needed new variable, right? And he's how to satisfy the rules, as I already explained now. By contrast, Deriano arrived at mathematical architecture of the finite dimensional from in a more first principle-like way, in particular, completely independently of classical physics, right? This is accomplished by the rule governing the structure of operational devices. These rules are more empirical, but not completely. That is to say, in a certain sense, they are not completely empirical because just like in Heisenberg, you had the arrangement of the key element, there are certain rules which will govern the arrangement of operational devices through which these things could be discovered, right? So I think that they refer to Bob Cox, who makes an interesting observation. So the underlying mathematical foundation of the high-level diagrammatic formalism relies on monoidal categories, right? So say a very general formalism, which could describe almost everything. However, look at the conclusion, right? So the challenge is to discover the necessary additional pieces of structure that allow us to predict genuine quantum phenomena, right? That is to say, that had to be still giving the structure through which you would have your prediction will be correct in the case of quantum theory. And use a little bit, so this arrangement could be called, as I mentioned before, kind of hybrid arrangement. They're both physical and mathematics, right? So here's from Lucian's paper, right? His description of the circuits. And then it's two assumptions which are made, right? Assumption one, the probability for any circuit, this has no open input, is well conditioned. It is therefore determined by the operations and the wiring of circuits alone as an independent of setting and outcome. I would say that this is a primarily physical postulate, okay, primarily. Now, the second postulate is a different story, right? The second postulate, the operations are fully decomposable, right? So, and first of all, this is a very important point. Lucian will correct me if I'm terribly wrong, right? Assumption two introduces a subtly different attitude than the usual one concerning how we think what an operation is. Usually, we think of operation as affecting a transformation of the system as they pass through. This is an almost classical type of way of thinking, right? Not quite, but. Here, we think of an operation as corresponding to a bunch of separate effects and preparations. We need not think of system as things, they preserve their identity as they pass through. We do not use the same labels for virus coming out of as ground in. This is certainly a more natural attitude when there can be different number of input and output system and when they can be of different types. Both classical and quantum transformation satisfies this assumption. In spite of the different attitude that just mentioned, we can implement arbitrary transformation such as unitary transformation as quantum theory by taking an appropriate sum of the separation. I skipped, by the way, something at the top, the quotation, that this decomposition is could be negative. As a general, it cannot be thought as physical mixing, right? So it's really a mathematical axiom. Now, then Hardy introduces here a physics to mathematics correspondence principle. For any physical theory, there exists a small number of simple hybrid statements that enable us to translate from the physical description to the corresponding mathematical calculation, such as mathematical calculation in appropriate notation looks the same as the physical description in appropriate notation. Now, here you have to be careful, in a sense, in my view, what is meant by description, right? I don't think that this needs to, Bohr also often refers to quantum mechanical way of description. But that does not mean that your description necessarily describes, let's say, the behavior of quantum object. It actually refers to your overall description of the structure through which these things are enacted. And the point which I want to make, right, is that you always have to introduce some mathematical structure into that arrangement. So the concept of circuit is, of course, very important because it's kind of symbolized the structure of measuring instrument which are capable of quantum measurement, right? But that is a really a crucial point. So in other words, let me just conclude here and say that in my view, what we confront here in that type of history which I trace here is very complex interactions between what I would call mathematical technology and physical technology and their interaction in the framework of probability theory. Thank you.
Yes.
So I have a large number of questions and comments, which I shouldn't make all of them, but let me start with this one. You have described an analogy between quantum mechanics and thermodynamics.
I didn't describe it. No. Einstein used it as an example of the principle theory.
You have said that both of them are principle, what Einstein called principle theory.
But they're very different.
That's all I meant.
Yeah.
But that's constitutes an analogy. In that respect, you view them as similar. Now, in the case, so I think that's partly true, although I would have a lot of disagreement with it if you tried to make it full nothing but a principles theory, because I think
quantum mechanics.
But quantum field, I mean, the standard model is not simply just a principles theory. The idea of quarks grew up. Anyway, that's not. Let me not dwell on that. Let me just fix on the question I wanted to ask, which is, if that analogy is correct, whatever you like to call it, if it's correct, then in the case of thermodynamics, we no longer regard it as a fundamental theory. We regard it, the thing which grew out of the kinetic theory, we regard as more basic, and it gives the explanation, although there are still some loose ends, of why thermodynamics works. So is it your point of view that we should be doing the same in quantum mechanics?
No.
In other words, we should be looking for the analog of statistical mechanics.
No, no, the opposite.
Kinetic, and if not, why not? Is that not just an arbitrary...
Well, of course, listen, I can't prevent
this. It's an arbitrary decree that you... It's like an ukaz that says you must not look for that.
I didn't say either way.
Einstein would take this position, although he didn't believe that that thermodynamics is strictly derivable from the kinetic theory mathematically. And obviously, no, you can pursue as a program. I'm just saying that in the program which I describe is not a program of the search for fundamental physical theory of the type of this relation. In fact, I should have even said that, because that's precisely kind of pair which is not a kind of program which I presented here. But it doesn't mean that you could not in principle search for such a program. I cannot forbid it, and I cannot claim that such a program is in principle unfulfillable. My point is simply that from the Bohr's point of view, it's not very likely to be fulfilled.
Based on what, though?
Based on a sense of the development of the quantum theory until his death, right? He didn't believe that it's likely to be fulfilled. But he didn't, look, Einstein believed that the ultimate theory would be constructive, classical-like theory in terms of representation. And Bohr's view was it may or may not be. That would be my position. It may or may not be. That is to say, it's possible that such a theory will be found, but it's also possible that it will never be found.
No, it's hard to argue with that.
Yeah, but that's as far as this is concerned, that's the only position.
Arkady, Lucy has a question.
So it's interesting to see this, that all of these ideas were around with Heisenberg back in the mid-1920s, and in some sense what we've been doing recently is looking at those ideas again. Is there anything, like if you've read those papers, is there anything from that work that we should be taking note of? Is there other ideas there that you think that would still be useful that perhaps perhaps were subsequently ignored because of the Schrodinger and so on?
That is an interesting question. I
think maybe If you do the quantum information theory for a continuous variable, maybe something will have to be found. It doesn't seem to me that quantum theory of discrete variables, because the conventional quantum mechanics doesn't contain spin. Of course, you have a Pauli spin theory, right? And you have a Dirac theory. My deep suspicion is that it is the Dirac, some of the aspect of Dirac's thinking, which I didn't describe that in great degree, which could prove to be useful. But it also has to be said, right, that in a certain sense, my argument always is a little bit different direction, in a sense, in saying maybe if we see the way Heisenberg was thinking, maybe we should think in terms of quantum information theory in the future of physics. I was kind of more saying, look, we look at back and these ideas could create quantum theory. So maybe if we do quantum field theory or something like that, we should look into quantum information theory. And in that sense, I might have a slide somewhere there, but it may not matter. It may not matter. Let me tell you this, because and Lucian and I talked about that program of operational quantum information theory, which was pursued by more Maurer, Adriano, and Lucian and co-workers, at some point split into somewhat different direction, because Maurer's work, his more recent paper is the derivation of Dirac equations from this principle. That would be a kind of answer to your question from the other way around. In a certain sense, my argument is we should look into quantum information theory for the future of physics, rather than maybe discover something in Heisenberg for quantum information theory, because I think quantum information theory arrived, you know, it's been a century, through some of the similar and related trajectory, while there are big questions to be posed certainly about quantum gravity and things of that nature, because in a way you can say, well, what is the point of rederiving quantum mechanics? Well, you could, of course, and again, we talked about that, understand better its fundamental principle, but it is also possible that it provides the venue for where we move forward, where we have now concern. Because in a way, you can say that the programs like string theory, right, are not quantum informational in presence, for example. For instance, that's a kind of interesting question. Convert string, of course, it's too loose, I understand that. Convert something like string theory in quantum information. What the hell does this mean, right? That could be an interesting idea. So my point is a little bit different. You look into the past in thinking about what is the role of this future, and the point of this is that it played a crucial role, this, some elements of this thinking, in the whole history of quantum mechanics. That would be the answer.
Given that we're over time by a fair bit, let me suggest that we end the seminar here, but I presume that if anybody has further questions, Arkady will be
I will be till 5, no?
I'm sorry?
I will be till 5 in this room.
Yeah, I think we can even stick around past 5 in this room. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm perfectly happy to answer all the questions.
But let me just sort of end the formal seminar at this point, and then anybody who wants to go can go.
Yeah.